Welcome to the Dr. Berkson's Best Health Radio Show. Today, the topic is tick-borne diseases. This is a serious topic because I teach at A4M in the gastroenterology module, and more of the gastroenterologists are saying they're not only finding gut diseases, they're finding a lot of tick-borne diseases that are linked to the gut diseases. So this is really an important issue for many people, not just if you have a tick-borne disease yourself. And on the show today, we have a medical sleuth. Dr. Green treated her first case of Lyme disease in 1989. Since then, she's closely followed Lyme and chronic infectious diseases via patient care, diagnosis, treatment, peer review science. She's considered one of the North American experts on tick-borne diseases because she's right on top of the ongoing research surrounding them and Lyme disease. But one of the cool things is that Dr. Green and I have been colleagues and girlfriends for many years. When I had breast cancer, in fact, I lived with her during my surgery in Palo Alto. And I remember that taking my coffee enemas in the bathroom almost drove her husband, Cordell, crazy. I really love Chris. She's one of the most agile thinkers and one of the most moral physicians that I know. And believe me, there's not too many moral people left on this planet. In the Kabbalah, in the Jewish religion, they always say at any given time, there's only 36 true moral people walking the planet. And I think Chris is one of those people. So anyway, the earlier in the course of tick-borne disease the treatment is started, the better for the patient and the worse for the microbe. So we're going to have the sleuth tell us all about this. So welcome to the show, Chris, Dr. Chris Green.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lindsay Berkson. And I would give back those compliments a hundredfold. You are one of the most agile thinkers I know, and also one of the most informed people at depths that startled me repeatedly. So thank you.
You know, I love that we work on patients over the years together. And when we have problems, we call each other up. You're really an infectious disease specialist that is in Los Gatos, California, and also had a clinic for many years in San Francisco. I think we practiced together for a really tiny period of time. Our clinics overlapped at the Center for Orthomolecular Medicine in Palo Alto. But anyway, to get to the show, what the heck is tick-borne disease? And we're going to talk about how to detect it, how to treat it, co-infections, and why there's so much controversy surrounding it. So take it away, Dr. Green.
All right. So tick-borne disease is a subset of vector-borne disease. And ticks, in this case, are the vector.
So, what does a vector mean for people who might not know that?
A vector means a blood-sucking something that's going to attach to you, the human, and transmit some kind of microbe or some kind of toxin occasionally, but mostly microbe, into the human blood and cause disease. So tick-borne disease is obviously caused by little ticks, which are arachnids. They're related to spiders. And the tick-borne diseases I look at mostly are those communicated by the black-legged tick. We call it the deer tick in this country. It's the sheep tick in England. It's all sorts of ticks worldwide, but it is a member of the same family of Ixodes ticks, I-X-O-D-E-S.
I think I dated a few of those.
You probably do. If they cling on very hard and if they inject a little anesthetic, so at first you aren't really aware that they're there. They're just hanging on. And these ticks are tiny. They are poppy seed size when they first latch on. And when they're full of blood, they're about a sesame seed size.
That's not very big. These are the ticks that do all that damage. They're that small.
These are the ticks. There are lots of ticks. There are also dog ticks that are bigger, and they cause some pretty bad diseases too. But the Ixodes tick is that small. And it's really true that ticks, unlike mosquitoes, inject a little bit of an anesthetic when they latch on, because they've evolved. They need to latch on for a while to be successful. So in their evolution, they've picked up some numbing molecules, and in they go, and you don't feel the bite.
Is this the Lyme tick that we're talking about?
This is the Lyme tick.
Okay.
That's
okay.
A black-legged tick.
Okay.
There are Lyme-like diseases, and you're in Texas. There are Lyme-like diseases that are communicated by other ticks. For instance, there's a tick called the Lone Star tick, which unfortunately has been found clear up on the Canadian border these days. It seems to be migrating. But the Lone Star tick will bite. And it's, by the way, a very aggressive tick.
Figures in Texas, everything's bigger.
Yeah, they actually swarm, almost like ants. Whereas the Ixodes tick finds people accidentally. We're an accidental host for it. But the Lone Star tick communicates something called star eye, which is southern tick-associated rash illness. And for all intents and purposes, the rash you get from it looks exactly like Lyme disease. And the illness often mimics Lyme disease, but we can't grow the same bug out of there. We haven't quite figured out what that bug is causing that disease.
Why are there these troublesome ticks around? Why are they in nature? Why does this isness exist?
Well, something you may not know about me is my major out of college was ecology. So this is a very interesting question to me. And interestingly, I just read an article that said there is no evolutionary reason for ticks to exist.
That's my question.
And I'm not sure about that. You know, usually when you are exchanging blood and organisms, what you're really doing is creating some level of diversity. And this gets a little bit too theoretical, but often the way our DNA adapts to an environment isn't mutation, isn't that Darwinian point mutation, but rather that we might acquire a genome. And in that genome, say we have a viral genome. Turns out 50% of human DNA is actually viral.
I know, and we haven't even delved into that. So is there any way that these ticks, the bad stuff is tick disease, but could the good stuff be that they have a positive contributory input into our viral genome?
Well, I wouldn't say viral genome. I would say the question is, do they have somehow a positive input into our genome? And I don't think so. And I certainly have never read a paper that says so.
So they're Mother Nature's shadow side, man.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they definitely are expanding. And you can go to the Center for Disease Control website and kind of look at maps over the years. And there are many reasons that may be true. Some people have suggested.
You mean that they're growing, that their presence on the planet is growing?
Their region is expanding.
And they're also evolving in terms of ability. Right? Growing and evolving? Is that accurate?
And
I've heard you say
evolves.
That.
And yes. And it either adapts better to its environment or loses. But ticks are mostly spreading in terms of getting into more and more areas where they weren't seen before. And the theories are maybe we've destroyed the predators for deer, because these are deer ticks. They have to be on a deer for their mating cycle. Otherwise, they can't survive. So deers are kind of, you know, they're the locomotives of travel, right? But they also bite birds. And there are several papers out of Canada that show that songbirds will carry these ticks long, long distances. And that's how they end up dropped on islands or dropped in various places across continents. But it may also be as we see plants evolving northwards, we see these warmer and warmer plants coming northwards, the ticks are following, just as the mammals follow. So something that I should say, so people understand, is while this is called a deer tick, it's not the deer that bring these ticks close to humans. These ticks like to bite almost anything, and they love small mammals. So if you're a happy gardener in your backyard, the mice and the squirrels are going to bring those ticks into your vicinity. If you're hiking out on that trail, it's still the small mammals primarily that are the host animal for these ticks.
It's making, you know, so we're going to talk about what exactly tick disease is, but knowing that these ticks can cause disease and you can get it gardening or hiking, it's making a lot of people very worried about being outside in nature. What's the reality of that?
The reality is that I think, and this is now me thinking, because I think we got very comfortable with believing nature was benign. Not an area where lots of things happen. There's so much life out there. We aren't the only life out there. And all life is trying to adapt and live longer and be happier and get to boogie, whether you're the size of a single-celled bacteria or a human. So what I think probably happened is the bug spraying that was done with very toxic substances that could have led to things like your breast cancer.
Like the DDT, yeah.
Exactly. Really wiped out a lot of things. It may be that. It may be that we didn't recognize the illnesses, because they're very subtle illnesses. They're called stealth bugs, these bugs.
And we can talk about S-T-E-A-L-T-H, for those of you that didn't quite hear that word, stealth bugs.
And I will tell you, Lindsay, you might say that, tell your care providers that are listening, a very good paper to read that really helped me understand clinically what's going on with these patients is called Stealth Pathogens, and it's by Merrill, M-E-R-R-E-L, and Falkow, F-A-L-K-O-W, in Nature in 2004. Definitely, if you're treating tick-borne diseases, read that paper. But what's occurring...
Can you just give us the two bullet points of what that paper said?
So that would be talking about stealth pathogens. I absolutely can. So a stealth pathogen is a pathogen, is an infection, right? A bug that's going to infect you. And instead of kind of jumping in, like you might get with typhoid fever or strep throat, and the bug looks around and says, uh-oh, the immune system's on to me. I'm going to run and replicate as fast as I can, and I'm going to outrun it. The stealth pathogen enters the body and hides, and it becomes a guerrilla warrior. So it actually has adapted to alter the innate immune response. If you or I get a bacteria in our blood, we have, our white cells have a chemical pickup to that bacteria that's automatic. It goes, uh-oh, and in milliseconds, it's on to it. Right? What these stealth pathogens have done is fixed it so that they have a little umbrella. And the innate immune system doesn't know they've come in.
They're hidden.
Yeah, they're hidden. And they're hidden long enough usually that they can kind of move about the body, get into what we call safe areas or protected areas.
What would that be?
Privileged sites.
What would privileged sites in the body be?
In the central nervous system, we don't let a lot of inflammation occur in the central, and that's the brain and the spinal cord,
right? It's so interesting. I'm writing a book on oxytocin. We won't go there, but oxytocin has a lot to do with modulating inflammatory processes in the central nervous system, which makes sense because it's one of the first birthing hormones that the whole baby is surrounded by because the mother's bloodstream is filled with it during pregnancy. So we can get into this another time, but I'm so interesting that you're saying this because I think oxytocin is very disrupted by our endocrine disrupting a robustly toxic planet at the moment. So we have maybe human nervous systems that are even more available for these pathogens mm-hmm. to privilegedly hide, as you put it.
Well, and other areas might be the synovium. You know, the lining of the joint is relatively low in blood supply, so you don't have a whole lot of delivery of white cells there.
And the disc,
many others. So these stealth pathogens get in and hide. Later on, they actually have the ability to alter the second part of the immune response, which is called the adaptive immune system. So there's a general screen, which is innate. We have guards that just check whatever's coming in automatically. But then we might say, oh, that bug is not one we want in here. It's not a friendly bug. It's not one of our happy, nice gut bacteria that we want around or skin bacteria. So we're going to target it. We're going to make an antibody, a very specific antibody to that bug. And these pathogens also alter that response, are capable of altering that response. They tend to be intracellular, just like a virus. A virus has to be intracellular because it doesn't have the mechanisms to replicate itself. So it sneaks inside our cells and uses our mechanisms to do that.
Sneaky.
Some of these vector-borne diseases that I'm talking about are bacteria, and they also become intracellular, which again is a protected site in terms of the white cells charging around your blood and looking for trouble and also sitting in your tissue. So that's when you get into mast cell situations is these clever stealth pathogens.
So is Lyme disease a clever stealth pathogen?
Lyme disease is definitely a clever stealth.
Can you tell us exactly what Lyme disease is now?
So Lyme disease is a disease caused by a Borrelia organism, which is actually a beautiful bacteria. It's a spiral bacteria. And the Borrelias have been associated with diseases called relapsing fever for many, many years. And when Lyme first was discovered by Dr. Willie Burgdorfer, it was actually placed in the relapsing fever category because it was a Borrelia and everyone thought it was a relapsing fever. They've taken it out of there, and I'm not a microbiologist. So the way they slice and dice what they're going to call or what category to put this bug in has to do with genetic changes and kind of evolution over time. So it got moved out. But, you know, it's interesting because it still acts a little like a relapsing fever, except it's so stealthy and clever, it prevents the body from having a fever, which, as you know, fevers help the immune system. It speeds it up, gets it going. There's a reason we get hot and bothered when we get a bug.
Right. That's why when we're older, because we can't mount a fever as well, we're more susceptible to a lot of things in a bad way.
Exactly. One of the reasons. And again, getting into the theory, is that because we've acquired a lot of these funny bugs that we haven't recognized until recently can cause chronic and persistent infections. So Lyme disease, again, is caused by this spirochete. You acquire it from an Ixodes tick. There are many, many strains of the Lyme bacteria. There are probably 300 species.
Now, why would that be? You know, why would nature do that? And one other, and if you see that there's a Lyme tick on you, if you flick it off, are you safe? Are you only really vulnerable if it stays on there? And then,
This is a very good question. If you read many of the recommendations about ticks, it's argued that you can't get Lyme specifically. Other diseases, which hopefully we'll at least allude to here, you can get much more quickly. But it will say that the tick has to be attached for 36 hours.
Otherwise, you're not really...
No, not true. This is not true. I'm just saying that that information is out there. There is one paper about transmission of Lyme within 4 hours. And what those numbers are based on are laboratory studies with naive ticks that are infected with Lyme and then allowed to attach to an animal and see how long it takes.
Explain what a naive tick is, because people think maybe that's just a tick that doesn't have table manners. What does that mean for the audience?
That means a tick, in this case, without Lyme disease.
Okay.
A clean tick.
So then they insert the Lyme disease into the tick. So not all ticks have Lyme disease?
Not all ticks have Lyme disease. And the amount of Lyme disease in the tick does vary region to region. Uh-huh. And there are many reasons we think for that. But certainly if you're in the northeast or the north central part of this country, there's a higher incidence of Lyme. Although Lyme has been described in every state, and I would tell you that the second Lyme disease study in the nation, the first one starting in about 1976 or so, but the first second Lyme disease study was in Northern California. And we have quite a load of Lyme disease out here. As you know, I'm from California.
So dealing with patients, since you deal with them all the time, how long do you think a Lyme tick has to be on you for you to worry about getting treatment?
Probably a few hours in some cases is enough. And the reason I say that is this was based on naive ticks, ticks in a laboratory that are new to bite that animal. But in nature, we know that sometimes ticks attach, start their feed, and then fall off and attach to another animal. The reason it was thought that it took so long is the Lyme bacteria is in the tick's stomach. And when they bite, it takes a while for that Lyme to come up to the mouth parts.
Oh, interesting.
But Dr. Bergdorfer, in looking at ticks from nature, sometimes found Lyme already in the mouth parts.
Ah, okay. So you just don't know.
So there's a lot, you know, I am an ecologist. And sometimes we act like what we see in the laboratory is what we're going to see exactly in a biologic system. Biologic systems are really complicated. This isn't physics.
Definitely.
And so all sorts of things happen out
there. It always
there.
Makes me crazy on dating sites when somebody says, I want low maintenance and no drama. And I think to myself, they have no understanding of biological systems.
I did have a patient who hiked into an area here called San Antonio Open Space and hiked out 5 hours later. Now, this is simply observation, so we can't lead it to, you know, absolute. But as he got to the car, he was scratching his head and he felt something. He happened to be hiking with a doctor. The doctor looked, he had a tick. They sent the tick into the lab to see what was in it. It had Lyme disease. We did a PCR, so we looked for DNA to the Lyme bacteria in him, and he had it. So at least in that case, we have a 5-hour likely infection and transmission.
Would you remember when I had Lyme disease? Remember years ago I had Lyme disease when I lived in Santa Fe?
I
had been hiking in Minnesota, And I didn't know anything really about Lyme. This is almost 25 years ago, and it wasn't so popular and known then. They were very stealth then. And I was laying on a rock, and I never remember seeing a tick on me at all, except I saw the bullseye. I never remember seeing a tick on me. And then 6 months later, I got neurogenic Lyme, although I'm lucky because I'm one of the few people who got rid of it. And I know we wanted to go into that at another time. We are going to, of course, talk about treatment, but I don't even remember seeing a tick on me.
So let's talk about that, because most people don't see a tick. And this is not a controversial statement. They did some vaccine trials, which involved over 5,000 people years ago, and these were very carefully monitored cases. Only about a fourth saw the tick. And that's people who are looking for it, right? This tick, again, look at an ecology. Let's look at it from the eyes of the tick. If the tick is successful, you never know he's been there. He's on there for 24, 48 hours, however long it takes him to expand his little blood meal, and then he's gone.
What happens in Tick Vegas stays in Tick Vegas.
One of the best things to do if you want to prevent or really watch for problems is if you've been outside, which hopefully we're all outside. I am in California and I love to run outside. I love to be outside. Then the next morning, you should carefully check your bedclothes, because likely timing-wise, that's when the tick will drop off.
And in the morning,
and you obviously should, when you come in from the outside, shed your clothes. Don't wear them again until they've been in a hot dryer for 10 minutes if they're dry. Ticks survive washing machines. They survive showers. I'm a swimmer. I swim 3 times a week, over a mile. I flip turn. I once had a tick on my back, probably for a week and a half, because I kept having an itch. And I kept forgetting to ask it was right the middle of my back. And lo and behold, I felt a wiggly something some weeks later and was trying to scratch it, and it was a tick. So,
but you didn't get Lyme disease? It wasn't a Lyme tick?
At that point in time, I can't remember, because quite frankly, I treated myself. Excuse me. I went to a colleague who treated me.
We must be so politically correct. Okay.
So ticks is very important to always do tick checks. You asked about being outside, and people can be outside. But as I said, I think we've gotten to think that outside is fine and forgotten that all kinds of life is out there, and all kinds of life wants to be successful. And that means that they might want to get in us and survive, although we are a mistaken host for the Lyme tick. In general, humans are not who the Borrelia wants to get into mice.
So what are the symptoms of Lyme disease?
So the symptoms of Lyme disease, as you kind of alluded to with your own situation, are variable depending on the stage of the Lyme. So when the tick first bites you, what you have is non-disseminated Lyme disease. The Lyme is in the skin. And you said you saw a rash. The other thing I will tell you is at least about 30% of people don't see a rash. And that's Center for Disease Control statistics, which are the most conservative we can have. If you read the general literature, up to 50% of people don't see a rash. And I said that there are many species and strains of the Borrelia, and we know that maybe 7 to 10 of them cause disease in humans. We know that already. And the strain may cause different symptoms, including more likely or less likely to cause a rash.
I remember I had a really bad heel pain, and there was a certain strain that you talked about that caused that, and that even helped us diagnose what it was, because along with the other symptoms, which were swelling of my fingers and insomnia, and I couldn't think. I never have brain fog in my whole life, and my whole brain, I just had no ability to focus, but I had this exquisite heel pain, and that helped you identify which strain it was, I think.
Yeah, and let's talk about that. So the initial, when you first get Lyme, if you're lucky enough to get sick, it is usually described in the literature as a summer flu. And depending again where you are in the country, we can get Lyme anytime in California because we have this wonderful weather. But if you're in the Northeast or the snowy areas, the most likely time is April to July. And if you get a viral infection, when you don't expect to have viral infections, you have to ask yourself, who else around me had a viral infection? Did I just get off a plane from Asia? You know, is that why I've got a viral infection? But otherwise, a summer flu would be a tick-borne disease until proven otherwise, as if you've been outside. So what does that mean? People get achy. People feel sick. They feel like, oh my gosh, I'm coming down with something. They can have migratory joint sensitivity. You talked about
my fingers swelled up like sausages.
Yeah.
I couldn't even use my hands. But this took place 6 months after I got bit.
Well, and let's talk. So I'm still in early Lyme disease. So this is the early. And then the other thing that's a little unusual for a viral infection would be paresthesia. So numbness, tingling, shooting pains, your sensory nerves sending you information. And again, it's often migratory. What does that mean? If you slip a disc in your back, that's a paresthesia that's really a bad one, right? And it's only in one location wherever that nerve is being. But Lyme moves around, so you get numbness in your right hand, and then you get a little pinprick in your left toe, and so that kind of migratory feeling sick, sometimes a low fever, but if we're talking Lyme, not often, and that's kind of what early Lyme looks like. If you miss it, if the diagnosis, if you're unlucky enough to not note the tick bite, not see the rash, and what I would tell you is not seek help, because you aren't that sick, right? And you think maybe it's a viral infection, and you miss it, then you can get into what we call disseminated Lyme disease. So that Lyme can go from the skin into the brain within 12 hours. It is not very selective in its tissue. It seems to prefer brain, heart, joint lining called the synovium, and soft tissue. It likes collagen, which means it can go anywhere. But it's been found in white cells traveling around. It's been found in a cell called the fibroblast, and fibroblasts can become different cells. So, and it's also one of the fastest bacteria known. It has four flagella, and it just zips, and it can go right through.
Flagella are kind of like little tails that propel.
They're little tails, yeah. In this case, it's not a tail because it's inside the membrane.
Uh-huh.
But it's really interesting.
Internal tail, internal little flippers.
Flippers is a good way to think of them. Exactly right. So if you are unlucky enough to not note the Lyme early, if we treat the Lyme within 3 months, only about 8% of people remain ill later, remain with symptoms later. If it takes over 2 years, 60% of people, Forshung did this work, 60% will continue to have symptoms later. So this is disseminated Lyme disease, and it can cause many, many symptoms. You mentioned not being able to think or talk. That's called encephalopathy. It's well described, again, for your medical types in papers by Logigian, L-O-G-I-G-I-A-N, and I think 91 and 99. Really good description. But basically, if I did what we call a mental status exam, the person would probably pass it. They might have some trouble in what we call serial sevens, or maybe in remembering three things over a 5-minute time, but basically they pass it. But if you started asking them questions, it turns out they're having trouble remembering things. They might ask their family members to call them about appointments because they know they're going to forget. They might switch words around. They might not be able to remember a string of numbers the way they used to remember a string of numbers. So you have the encephalopathy. You also have worsening, usually, neuropathy. So some kind of peripheral nerve sensations, whether it's, again, numbness, tingling, sometimes electric shooting pains, which have a different etiology. You can get autonomic neuropathies. You can get something called POTS, which is kind of when you stand up, you might faint.
POTS is a growing epidemic. I know the Mayo Clinic has said 1 out of 100 teenage and young adult females is being diagnosed with POTS. You might want to.
And I will tell, well, we have made that obvious through the eyelids treatment, but basically I've had, and it does seem to affect young women more than young men, but old women get it, old men get it, and young men get it. And I have had many cases of POTS simply disappear once we successfully treat this bug. The reason you get POTS with Lyme and other orthostatic problems is that Lyme, again, is non-selective. And it goes into that into that autonomic nervous system, into the vagal nerve, and messes with you. Whatever the mechanisms are that translate what I would tell you frequently, the persistent infection is causing inflammation in those areas, causing inflammation in your vagus nerve, which is your parasympathetic nervous system, as I know you know, and that's the autonomic nervous system. So not only is POTS an epidemic, Lyme is an epidemic. Tick-borne disease
is an
epidemic.
It seems like it's an epidemic. You're hearing it all the time now. It seems
it turns out reported cases of Lyme directly to the Centers for Disease Control are about 37,000-40,000. But given that we have big data abilities, given that we can now look at insurance data, ICD-9 and ICD-10 codes, in 2015, the Center for Disease Control said, actually, new cases of Lyme disease are not greater than 30,000 a year, as we've been saying. They're greater than 300,000 a year. Now, what does that mean in terms of health of the population? So, in that 300,000, 10 to 20% will go on to have chronic neurologic disease, neuroborreliosis. Another very high number, up to 60%, will go on to have joint arthritis that can be severe, that can be debilitating. So we need to really get a handle on how to diagnose this disease early. And what I would tell you as a doc who teaches fundamentals of Lyme disease and tick-borne disease, that what we need is we need our doctor first responders. We need those ER docs. We need our pediatrician. We need our general practitioners and our family docs and our general internists to have Lyme in their differential. So again, if someone comes in with a summer flu, not to automatically say you have the flu, bye-bye, go home, and you'll be okay in a few weeks, because you will. most likely, even if it's Lyme, it's just going to come back and visit you later, at least in 10 to 20% of 300,000 people plus a year.
Which is a lot.
That's a whole lot.
And when it happens to you, as it happened to me, it was severe and debilitating. Can you just make a mention? I want you to keep going on what you're going on to, but what was that thing with the heel pain? Because I remember I had one more slight recurrence of it, and I had that heel pain come back with the recurrence. But then we can go later when we talk about treatment, what I did to treat and what you do to treat. But do you remember what you felt that meant? It was a strain that came from Europe that presented with a heel pain? And if not, we'll just let that go. But
it's actually, fast forward to the modern day, perhaps a little bit different. So you get these migratory pains, and that heel pain can be a plantar fasciitis, right? Or it can be an Achilles tendonitis. I have a patient who's a nurse who...
But it was funny because as soon as I got rid of the Lyme, it went away. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Dr. Bean, my itises are coming back. I'm sure I'm flaring again. And in a funny way, it's a good way to think about it, because these are they inflame the nerves. A guy named Paul DeRay, at the very beginning of Lyme, wonderful guy who worked with Steer actually and was a pathologist, asked a question: does Lyme cause a vasculitis? Does it inflame the blood vessel? Or does it inflame the nerve? And what DeRay found, and others have found since him, including surgeons, is if you open up the nerve sheath, the Lyme is inflaming the nerve itself. And that hurts, or the nerve goes wrong, you feel like there's water, or your heel really hurts. Now, there is different strains around the world, and before we diagnosed Lyme disease here, in Europe, they diagnosed a disease that they called Banwas syndrome. It had different names, but was also caused by a Lyme bacteria that's called Guarinii, is the one that goes to the nerves the most in Europe. And then Aphzelus likes the skin and causes more soft tissue problems. And Guarinii is the one that I was probably thinking of in you.
I think that was
However, in the current day, if you start going on to Lyme blogs, et cetera, from patients, they are firmly convinced that heel pain and burning bottom of the feet is caused by another organism completely called Bartonella. And Bartonella is, unfortunately, a rising star in the stealth pathogen chronic problem area. Bartonella is carried by 40% of all cats worldwide. Wild, domestic, doesn't matter. They carry this bug, they're the reservoir for it, and it's communicated by a flea as well as by a tick. So it's probably more common. And in the modern day, many people, now these, when you start getting into clinical symptoms, until you do very careful big data studies, we can't be sure. For instance, when the tick bites, they're dirty. They've got a lot of bugs in them. They give us a lot of bugs. Most of them don't infect us. A few of them do. So if you get, and I'm going to go astray a little bit, raid me in if you want. Say you get bit by a tick and you get not only Lyme bacteria, but you get a bug called Babesia. And Babesia is a real problem. It's a stealth pathogen and it's not a bacteria. It's a malaria-like parasite. So I can treat you for your Lyme because, whoop, look, there's a rash there we're going to treat, and I can totally miss the Babesia. So we have to know symptoms of babesiosis.
What are those symptoms?
But I'm going to tell you, but Babesia Lyme co-infection has not been studied clinically, right? So I can tell you what I see in my office, and I can tell you what Babesia itself causes. Babesia, you get bit by a tick with Babesia, you're much more likely to have a fever, at the outset. You're much more likely to have real sweats. You'll look like you're sick with an infection, or chills. you know, which is the flip side of sweating. Babesia is a red blood cell parasite, so you often have some shortness of breath. They call it air hunger. It feels a little different than if you have emphysema. People feel like they can't get a breath. And you can actually clinically see this in your exam. In fact, in your history, because they'll often, without knowing it, pause and take a big breath and go on. I call them clearing breaths of babesia. And babesia Lyme patients in my office are the ones more likely to have POTS and dysautonomia, have trouble with their autonomic nervous system. Another thing you see in these patients, and again, we're talking now disseminated late, probably longer than 6 months, although you very occasionally see this early on, is what we call dependent erythema. Their nerves don't work so well, and so their vessels start pooling some blood in their feet.
Which is very POTS-like, yes.
It's very POTS-like. And so if you sit the patient on the edge of your exam table and let their feet just dangle as you talk to them and you examine them, those feet are going to slowly turn red and purple. Some people will be symptomatic. Some people will tell you they wake up at night with their feet burning and they have to, you know, stick them out of the covers, and in the extreme, they have to go get ice. But the majority are asymptomatic, except that they know their feet are purple.
And that's a babesia symptom, you're saying?
Well, that can also be, again, we don't know co-infection. We both don't know it when we're looking at the laboratory, which we haven't quite entered yet.
Yeah, we're going to go there soon about what tests you run to figure all this out.
Or clinically. So what has happened because, well, I would tell you, others might disagree with me, in about 2008, the Center for Disease Control says we don't need any more studies on Lyme because we figured it out, okay? They thought they had figured it out. So studies for this kind of
thing. That's just so amazing.
Like co-infection.
The narcissistic. That, if anything, shows the personality spectrum of it, that is narcissism. We've learned it all. We know we need nothing more.
You know, it's interesting because I've thought the same thing in kind of an arrogance. Like we think we're so much more important than bacteria that bacteria are going to continue to figure out ways to get around us.
They evolve. I remember you telling me this in all of our many conversations over the years about these bugs, because you and I every now and then talk and I just sit and take notes. You tell me about their ability to evolve because all life on Earth is constantly evolving. We could also make the case for de-evolving, but...
Exactly. In some ways, a better word is adapting. All life is going to adapt to their environment the best they can. It turns out Lyme has, I don't know how many they're up to, over 20 plasmids. Plasmids are small pieces of DNA that bacteria carry that make them more adaptive to the environment. They can share those plasmids. That's how you share resistance, or the bacteria share resistance. And so if you just went on the genome, Lyme is the smartest, most adaptive bacteria out there. The runner-up is chlamydia, and it only has 7 plasmids to Lyme's. I can't remember if it's up to 30 or still at 20-something.
Lyme could be pretty arrogant about how many plasmids it has. Maybe the CDC has plasmids. I don't know. So how do you test for these bugs?
So I have to get a little bit on my bandwagon here because it's very important to me that the patient is still looked at in this story, that an exam still occurs, and that a history of the present illness still occurs. So when I was in medical school in the ancient past, I was taught that by the time I had taken a medical history from the patient and done my exam, that I knew the diagnosis. And I used the laboratory to confirm that diagnosis. I believe this is still good medicine. So the way—
Amen, and not a lot of people do it this way anymore. So thank you for bringing this up, Chris. Thank you. Yeah. This is so critical.
Well, if you're a doctor whose productivity is being measured by your billing the way a lawyer is, and you're allowed 10 minutes with a patient or 15 minutes with a patient, I don't know how you can do medicine. So with Lyme and tick-borne disease, the history is very telling. If you have acute Lyme, we've gone through it. Is it summer flu, or maybe in here in California, a flu and flu season while you're scratching your head about why this flu looks a little bit different than another flu and why this person who wasn't around any sick person got sick. But in late, or, and I haven't mentioned this and I need to, or persistent Lyme. So if we talk about Lyme, let's say after 6 months, what we're talking about is either late Lyme, which I've mentioned means you didn't get diagnosed. We missed
it. You know,
it.
When I had mine, I didn't have any early symptoms, or maybe I was run down because I finished lecturing for 2-3 days straight, and I just thought that that was just fatigue from
exactly.
lecturing.
And this is one of the strategy of stealth pathogens. They're indolent. They get in, and the patient, most likely who's healthy and well, thinks exactly what you thought. Oh, my gosh, I just got back from that hiking trip. Oh, my gosh, you know, I've been burning the midnight oil at work recently. Oh, my kid's been sick and I've been helping them. That, you know, because the symptoms are not terribly specific in that early Lyme. So often that's the reason for missing. Often the patient has been into the doctor and been told they have a viral infection. It'll go away. And it does go away. It might take a little longer, but it does go away, and then it resurfaces. So this late Lyme is that kind. There's also a Lyme that says you've been treated, but the symptoms either never resolve or come back. And the treatment for Lyme would be 21 days. The standard treatment, if such a thing can be said, is not the right treatment. I hasten to say that, but I'm going to tell you what it is.
So you're going to tell us the standard treatment that's wrong and then the right treatment that should be standard.
Right. Okay. Now, if you're really good at seeing early Lyme, and it is early, this might be the right treatment, which is doxycycline 100 milligrams 2 times a day for at least 21 days. If the patient is not well, and these are guidelines, which I sent to you in that second email I sent.
Right, we're going to put a lot of guidelines in the show notes. So everyone, there's going to be incredible show notes for this show. If you go to drlindseyberkson.com, we have the write-up of what you're going to learn in the show, but Dr. Green has kindly given us tremendous number of resources. I was just amazed at what you sent. Thank you so much. And it will be available on iTunes, where the show is on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify. It's all around. You can get to it from my website, drlindseyberkson.com. And we have very specific show notes that Dr. Green has given us all these resources. And then below that, if you love information like this, look at what an agile thinker Dr. Green is. And look what we're learning here that you don't hear in most places. So if you love this information and you want to give us an iTunes review that helps iTunes promote this to more people around the world so they could share this with their docs, there is a set number of steps to tell you how to give a review. We would appreciate that because apparently you need to be a Mensa member to know how to do that on your own. So we give you the steps where you don't have to have 160-point IQ.
All right. So, we were at persistent Lyme. So persistent Lyme means you get treated, but lo and behold, somehow that treatment wasn't successful and you're still sick with persistent symptoms. You take that history from the patient and you see what your differential is. And this is extremely important in tick-borne disease. I hastened to say to the doctors, you must do your differential. I have found meningiomas, brain tumors in people who thought they had Lyme disease. I have certainly found different types of spinal problems, you know, whether it be arthritis, et cetera. So you do have to make that differential. Then you move into the exam room. Often in Lyme disease, certainly in a short exam, it will appear that there are no what we call exam findings. So these are objective things. But if you do a very careful neurologic exam, you will frequently find things that are not normal. You might find a tremor in a very young person who says, no, there's no tremor in my family. You might find uneven pupils at rest. You might find a little bit of facial palsy, which is usually called Bell's palsy, although when there's a reason for it, we call it facial palsy. Bell's is what we call idiopathic. It just happens and we don't know why. So after I do those exams, then I think I know the diagnosis, but I have a tree, I have a differential. Like I might think, this person developed terrible headaches and has not had headaches before. I have to make sure they've had an MRI because, of course, we have to look in the brain and make sure there's not something blood vessel-wise going on that has nothing to do with a tick-borne disease. So I go to there, and then we go to the lab to confirm it. And herein, if we're talking Lyme.
So let's just let you, so you do an intake and then a physical, you rule out organic disease, and then you come with a suspicion of Lyme, and now you're talking about the labs you will run to confirm your suspicions.
All right, except I would tell you Lyme is an organic disease. So I stand corrected. I'm going to make the tree. Now, it is really true that a patient can have tick-borne disease and something else, right?
Oh, tis true.
But nonetheless, my job as a doc is to really define what's going on in that body, what's wrong. And so if indeed I think it's an active infection with a tick-borne disease, I'm going to try to prove that in the lab. What I will tell you, and this is straight from the guidelines, in Lyme specifically, there's no test. The testing's lousy. And everyone agrees to this. You asked me about the controversy in Lyme disease. Both sides, I mean, Paul Meade, who's head of vector diseases, vector communicated diseases at the CDC, has said that the... the level of evidence we have for diagnosing Lyme disease is poor. The quality of the evidence is poor. In the ILADS guidelines, which I sent you with that second send, same thing. They grade. So in guidelines, if we're doing them the way the Academy of Medicine wants us to do them, we grade our evidence. So our job is to read everything out there that's peer-reviewed on whatever it is we're covering in the guidelines. And then we say, oh, this particular study was a randomized controlled study with good statistics. We're going to rank it as, you know, good. And if it was a case report, well, that level, unfortunately, is lower, right? Because we aren't sure we can generalize that data.
Case report is just a case about a patient, but it doesn't mean that it can be generalized to many other patients.
Exactly. And so, unfortunately, the evidence we have on the treatment of Lyme disease is graded as mostly poor, or I'm sorry, on the laboratory diagnosis of Lyme disease. So the treatment is also there. So the test that is most usually done is an ELISA, which is looking for antibodies. So it's an indirect test. It's looking for the body's response to the bug. In infectious disease, the Cadillac or the Mercedes-Benz or maybe the Tesla these days, is to be able to culture, to be able to say, I took blood out of that patient, I put it, and I cultured that bug out. Here's the problem with these stealth pathogens. They aren't in the blood. They aren't in the fluids.
They're in those privileged little hidden places. That's why they're stealth.
That's what we call tissue-based. And it's interesting. There's a fair amount of research in Bartonella where they're doing an old kind of diagnosis, which is called confocal microscopy. They're staining for the bug and looking through a microscope that can try to look at 3D and finding biofilms in people's hearts that contain sometimes both Lyme. In fact, I had a patient like this, both Lyme and Bartonella. But those are not yet commercially available. They're working on them. That's University of Minnesota. A researcher named Marna Erickson, which anything she's written is really interesting too.
If Lyme is hidden somewhere, would it still be pumping out some genetic material that could be picked up by genetic assays?
Yeah, good question. So what is being looked at right now? There's a study at George Mason that's looking at proteins produced by different pathogens that are shed in the urine. And that's showing some promise. There are definitely, I will say, tick-borne disease right now is a hot area for diagnostics. And there is some work, really good work, being done at Hopkins on the bug itself. So we finally, with Lyme, have been able to culture the Lyme. For a long time, it was very hard to do this. And a wonderful researcher at University of New Haven, Ava Shappi, S-A-P-I, figured out how to culture this, which is interesting in itself, but we don't have time, so I won't do that.
We're not here for the next 3 days, but we're here for a little bit more time because this is just too great. But so can you now culture in your patients? Is that what you're saying?
No.
Or
no,
still academic?
Saying,
okay.
What I'm saying is this. So Eva and then later a somewhat famous microbiologist, Ying Zhang, Z-H-A-N-G, at Johns Hopkins, took those cultures of Lyme and did sensitivity testing, figured out what treatment in the test tube could kill the bug. That's how we get sensitivities. If you or I have a bladder infection and we go and they do a sensitivity on that, they're seeing what will kill that bacteria in the test tube. And Lyme's very interesting because it has two different states. It has a persister state and a spirochete and a growing state. All bacteria do, but as always, Lyme's the master. It really does his persister well. So what Zhang found...
What's a persister?
A persister is a form of a bacteria, let's say, that when the going gets bad, the bacteria will change itself.
So there's two states that it can exist in, and one it can kind of change to evade whatever is it assaulting it to stay alive, and the other. So it has two different states that exist in, and the problem is when you're going to be identifying it, which stage is it in? Is your testing apparatus going to be able to identify it?
That is one of the problems. And in fact, the way it changes into a persister is it changes how it looks. Remember, we're testing antibodies to identify this disease. Antibodies look at the outside of a bacteria. So if the bacteria changes its coat, like it does when it becomes
antibody. So the antibody test isn't accurate to pick up all the stages of the Lyme.
And there is research going on. It's not available to us yet, but there is research going on looking for that. You can also, since we're on labs, you can also look for, as you asked, genetic material of the Lyme. The data says you're more apt to get that positive in that early disease when the Lyme is out in the blood replicating or in the cerebrospinal fluid. But you do pick it up sometimes. I do it on my late patients who present. And I would say in my population, 20% probably come up positive of those who I think do have Lyme disease. But there is data. But what the test tube and the growing of the Lyme has allowed us to do is really test
what eradicates
it. Can eradicate that Lyme.
What kills the buggers, man?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Even the persister form. And then the trick is, where are they in the body?
I can't even wait. So what kills it? What kills it?
Even the
persister form.
That I would tell you in the test tube, but I hesitate to say this because you do not want to go to Lyme 401 as a practitioner before you've done 101 to 101. Because you don't want to treat someone who does not have persistent late, either persistent or late Lyme, and are really sick with neurologic disease with the three drugs that
I see. So there's specific drugs early on, and then as it gets more squirrely, there's more aggressive drugs later on, and you really need to know the difference as a practitioner.
Right. And the question is, should we be applying the aggressive drugs earlier? And that kind of research will happen with big
data. Are these all antibiotics?
I'm sticking right now to the antibiotics. If you're going to make a patient who's been sick for 10 years well, you're going to have to take care of whatever the infection is and then go to all the things you probably talk about on this program that will heal your nerves, that will reestablish your neural pathways, that will regenerate the tissue, that will get your immune system back. You do have to
You have to do a protocol. You have to eradicate the bugs, but you have to do a supportive terrain, bigger protocol. But I have a question for you. I remember you started me on antibiotics early on when I had the neurogenic late Lyme, disseminated Lyme. And then I talked to Dr. Wright and he recommended, which you were uncomfortable with, the whole blood irradiation and ozone treatment. I had 40 of those treatments and then I did a homeopathic along with it because I didn't seem to do so well with the antibiotics. And that's what eradicated it for me. I'm one of the rare birds that got rid of it with that treatment.
Well, I don't know if you're a rare bird. So whenever I hear these stories, I have to say, you don't know if the antibiotics helped.
That's true.
You don't know.
But I was on them that's true.
Not doing well with them was, you know, you're hitting them hard. And again, I hasten to say it's a case report. I have a lot of patients.
Case report meaning it was just my case. One person. Okay.
Yeah, you do UV irradiation, or who do that, who do ozone, who do herbals, and herbals can be extraordinarily effective in this disease and get helped with it. Cure of this disease, if it's really late, if you're talking more than 5 years, is difficult, complex, and we don't yet know all the parameters. So that's, you know, I have plenty of patients who come back and say, you know, Dr. Green, I got 50% better with you, but I went and did bloop, 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 you know, and then I got really better. And I think that's a whole nother show to talk about where you go with the potential inflammation that's still there or if you have something, anything in your brain that's causing a lot of swelling and inflammation, you're going not be able to fire the normal neural pathways. You're going to have to reroute things to function, right? To get those nerves back, you know, sometimes I say it this way. If I could wave a magic wand and the bug was gone, you wouldn't be well if you've been sick for 10 years.
So can you do this for us for right now? And I know this is huge because you've got early Lyme, late Lyme, you've got the different forms of Lyme, but can you give us...
And we haven't even touched co-infections.
Okay, so then before we go to that question, let's go to co-infections and we'll go. I know you know what I was going to ask. We'll go to my asking later. Please go to co-infections.
Okay, and I'll be brief because I know where. So when you said, okay, what's the cure? I thought, I can't tell you because you've got to know what you're treating. If you're down to just Lyme,
right,
we have a cure. We but it's too early to say that. But we may have something that will really eradicate the bug. But
what is that? What is that?
Well, that is simple antibiotics.
Okay.
That I'm going to drag my feet in saying, because I don't want to do harm. I'm happy, though, to answer questions to you. If you shoot me a question that a particular person has sent in, I'm happy to give you like the study. The study involved is by Zhang, Z-H-A-N-G. Ying is his first name. There are lots of Zhangs out there. So co-infections, frequently when you have late or persistent Lyme.
Is there something going on? I'm hearing a little bit of a...
You are hearing my parrot.
That's your parrot?
Yeah, I can maybe... Oh, no, I can't do that, can I?
Okay. Wouldn't that be cute if you have a parrot, you have a little teeny muzzle that you can put on? or if the parrot had an allergy and it had that little teeny like tube around its neck like a little dog gets when it comes out of the vet. I'm sorry, I just had a really comedic image there in my mind listening to this parrot. Okay, co-infections.
So, yeah, co-infections. So when... Many of the physicians treating persistent and late Lyme believe that someone's not well, that there's at least one other bug joining into the party. And as such, you have to identify if there's something else you think is active and go after that before you can eradicate Lyme. That's what, and I hate to use the words believe in this world, but that's what I would say clinically I have found, and that's what some of the data shows. For instance, if you get Babesia and Lyme, we do have evidence that those people are sicker, take more treatment before they're well. Same with Lyme and Ehrlichiosis. We also have data for that.
Are there different, is it different antibiotics, or how do you address?
Yes, it is different antibiotics. It's usually simpler, although Bartonella may be an exception, but it does have to be identified, you know. And Babesia, the other problem in treatment of these diseases is endpoint. Since our testing is lousy, we aren't sure how to tell when we've treated enough, when we've, you know, as you say, what if it's something else? What if it's that, you know, you have, I don't know how to say this in English, like antibody antigen complexes. You have kind of junk in your blood from the infection left over that almost leads you more in an autoimmune or an immunologic.
But it's not really a bug. It's really the downstream issues of the bug. Well, how do you identify these co-infections? Is that what you're thinking about now? I mean, how does a patient identify?
No. Okay, same thing. You do your clinical assessment. You go into the lab. And some of these co's have signs. For instance, Bartonella has particular rashes that are associated with it or particular skin manifestations. Babesia may. There is one clinician who has identified something on the skin with Babesia. So you do your normal exam history.
How about Ehrlichia?
The lab. And in the lab, there are direct tests for these bugs, meaning you can find the DNA, you can do PCRs. There are also
PCRs
RNA
to
tests.
Identify DNA of things. Okay.
And there are what we call FISH testing, which looks at RNA. RNA to a specific pathogen is only around if it's replicating. So you really nail an active infection if you've got a positive FISH test.
If it's growing, yeah. Okay.
And so you can do those testing. You can do antibody testing. And again, if you look for at Center for Disease Control, or it's not really them, but in terms of diagnosis, you look for a 3 to 4-fold change in titer in your serology, which you don't get in
line. Say that in English now for everybody listening.
Okay, so say I find some antibodies in a patient. If they change 3 times, either up or down, if I do serial testing over, say, every 2 to 3 weeks, then I should be able to track that antibody and say, aha.
But what doctor's really going to be doing that? Maybe you would do that, but how many doctors are really going to do serial testing on patients?
Now that's interesting. I would think most who are treating these diseases, because you do it to prove
you do. You do, Chris, but a lot of docs don't. Okay, so let's go to this is because it gets getting in depth and it's getting, you know, I don't want people to be drowning out there. So we got to throw them something for help.
Okay.
So can we just talk what are some basic antibiotics that are helpful and some basic herbals that are helpful and what you've seen work and not work in your patients?
Yes, I think we can. So doxycycline is the universal tick-borne disease antibiotic.
But that's early on, right?
And that's late too.
And late too.
Doxy
okay.
will cover Lyme, Ehrlichia, Anaplasma, a little bit Bartonella, and Rocky Mountain spotted fever, which we haven't talked about because it doesn't come from the same tick, but it's a very important pathogen to recognize because there's a mortality rate with it early on. So doxy is really your universal.
You know, it's interesting. In the old anti-aging conferences, they used to recommend that people, as one of the major anti-aging tools, take doxycycline in a small amount daily to kind of do away with these infections that you don't know you even have that could be shortening your lifespan and not and compromising your quality of life. So I think that's kind of one of the reasons, because it's so broad spectrum helpful in getting rid of stealth infections.
Yeah, and I think that's true. Unfortunately, the stealth infections have been busy. And if you read about most of these infections, just singly, you will read that you need at least 2 antibiotics targeting that infection to eradicate them. And then it becomes a little bit specific to infection. I personally like, for Lyme alone, an azithromycin, so what we call a macrolide, that's a Z-pack, if you will, plus a doxy. Because early studies showed that really killed the bacteria, was what we call bactericidal. I also would tell you, for the most part, 100 milligrams of doxycycline twice a day for an adult is inadequate. You have to give 200 twice a day. And again, I'm a little bit in early disease, because that'll kill the bacteria, whereas 100 won't. And I just checked this with a pharmacist colleague, because someone, a doctor, asked me to, because I say that in lectures, to document that, because she was being hassled by insurance about it. And it is documented. So
for those doctors out there listening, I have a lot of doctors and pharmacists that listen to this show. This is really good to know. Know the 200 milligrams BID, which is twice a day, is documented.
Okay, so mycoplasma, which is not something we've mentioned.
You know, that would be a good thing for you to send me, if you wouldn't mind, the citation for that document, and I can put that in the show notes at drlindseyberkson.com in the show notes under the podcast area. Okay.
Mycoplasma, which we haven't mentioned and is controversially tick-borne, but is certainly a bug that many, many of us have, also can be a chronic problem. And Dr. Jones, who is one of my mentors, Charles Ray Jones, who's a pediatrician, remarkable man in Lyme, he would tell you that in children, mycoplasma as a co-infection is a real problem. And for that, I, again, will use a low-dose, long-term azithromycin. And that comes from earlier chronic fatigue literature.
Do you find that in POTS patients to be helpful? The number of POTS patients that are not responding to a lot of the treatments you're discussing, and I'm wondering if that's a missing key. Is the how do you identify the mycoplasma infection?
Serology.
Serology? Okay, blood test.
IgM. Yeah. Okay. And mycoplasma is interesting because it has a world, it's not just tick-borne. It may not be tick-borne. But there are definitely outbreaks of mycoplasma periodically. I mean, I see them here, and I see them especially in the young teens, probably because they haven't been exposed in the past. And they get very high IgMs, and an IgM means active disease. So it is worth thinking about.
Okay, I have a patient right now I'm thinking of. I'm going to measure that on. Okay.
The other medication important to mention in this regard is your penicillins or your cephalosporins. If you look at the standard treatment for neuro-Lyme disease, say you have a meningitis from Lyme or approved encephalitis from Lyme, you will give intravenous ceftriaxone, ceftriaxone, for a month, 21 days to a month. And the cephalosporins definitely help brain Lyme. So that if I have someone who has brain symptoms, that encephalopathy we thought about, difficulty thinking, sometimes they have tremors, sometimes they have twitching, occasionally they have seizures, then I'm going to move to something like a cephalosporin, which are well tolerated orally. And the one that is most indicated is ceferoxime, ceferoxime, I think.
Can you also go now for the lay people that are listening? Can you go to some of the herbs that you think are helpful or homeopathics that you think are helpful? And what are they helpful for?
I'm not going to go homeopathics because I'm not trained there.
Okay.
I send out homeopaths, I don't do it. And I'm not an herbalist. So I base my herbal use on Stephen Buhner, B-U-H-N-E-R, who is a gifted herbalist and has written something like 6 books specifically on tick-borne disease. And I would refer people there. I don't want to name a brand of something here, but there are good mixtures, and maybe what I can do is add that to the list to you. There are good mixtures of Buhner's herbs. He will target all of the aforementioned co-infections as well as Lyme. And probably my favorite group, although I hesitate because I'm not an herbalist, are cordyceps, which will help your immune system but are also bactericidal at certain doses, and Cida acuta.
How do you spell Cida acuta?
S-I-D-A-A-C-U-T-A.
I never heard of that. What is that?
It's a Buhner herb is what I would tell you.
It's but a again, Steve Buhner not, herb. It's an herb.
Yeah. And what I do when I...
Let's put this in the show notes so people, if they do want access to his name... And,
okay.
You know, so people can, he has 6 books out on tick-borne disease and maybe, you know, cordyceps is often used in functional medicine to support kidney function. And you're saying it's also bactericidal and immune supportive. And then Cida acuta. So that would be nice to just have those mentioned in the show notes.
Okay.
So we're coming a little bit close toward the end. We've got a little bit more time, but what do you think we need to say to really clarify and help people out right now? What haven't we covered that you want to cover?
Perhaps this for patients.
Okay.
In terms of taking the history, at least for doctors like me who've been in this a long time,
you have a very agile parrot, by the way.
This is not totally tongue-in-cheek, but one of my colleagues will say, one of the diagnostic signs in the history taking of tick-borne disease is that the patient walks in with 10 diagnoses. They have fibromyalgia. They have chronic fatigue syndrome. They have irritable bowel syndrome. They have POTS.
What about mold?
They have, yeah, mold-related illness. They have, they have allergy, you know, just named allergy.
Mast cell sensitivities.
Yeah, and that's newer, that they're going to have mast cell activation syndrome. And what's interesting about those diagnoses, for the most part, is they all have the word syndrome in them. What does a syndrome mean? A syndrome means we don't have a cause. In medicine, you call a cause an etiology. We don't have a reason for those people to have that disease. We simply have described the disease, which is important to do, by finding 100, 1,000 people who really look the same. And it's important to do because then you can begin to study that group to try to figure out what is the cause, what is the trigger here. And there's another of my favorite papers argues, and I'll put this in too, that medicine and science has quit seeking causes and is simply looking for correlations. And correlations are not causes.
To give a pharmaceutical for.
Yeah. So I would tell both your patients and your care providers, if somebody's walking in with 15 syndromes or 5 syndromes, that person has been studied. They have been worked up, as we say in the trade, for anything that you could hang a hat on, and we can't find it. So we name a syndrome and we give them a drug that matches the syndrome.
Right.
Now, that's kindness because we want to relieve suffering, but it's not going necessarily, sometimes it will.
It's unsophisticated kindness, right.
Wellness. It sometimes will, because reducing inflammation sometimes lets your own immune system get into places that the inflammation kept it out of and take care of whatever the problem is.
That's an interesting statement right there. I just want to say that, you know, we know now that a lot of diseases are driven by low-level chronic inappropriate inflammation. And it's very interesting that you just said, because you're a very smart thinker, Chris, obviously, that inflammation in and of itself will sometimes not let the immune system get into the tissue to deal with what is the etiology of the inflammation. That's very, very interesting.
Yeah, and you know, that's not my thinking. I don't know if you remember David Berg and his work with people who had more tendency to clot. He started a laboratory called Hemex Laboratory. And he basically said, oh no, what's happening in these people who have more tendency, quicker to clot genetically than you or me, say, that when they get inflamed, when we get inflamed, we turn on our clotting system. We have to, and I won't go into
right,
why.
That's why your platelets go up and all that. Yes. Right, right.
But then if you clot a little bit too early when you're inflamed, you wall off the problem from the immune system. But I want to say one other thing. I think we've begun to make diagnoses based on inflammation. That's what fibromyalgia is. And it's not telling you why the inflammation's there.
Right, right, exactly. The cause, the true root cause. Right.
There's a big assumption in medicine that everything is autoimmune, that the immune system's gone crazy and decided to attack us. And in some cases, it is. But in many of the current cases, fibromyalgia being a good example, they haven't found any specific marker, any specific,
right.
Like in lupus, we have a specific thing that's being made that we know about. Same with true rheumatoid arthritis.
Yeah, that was their old Nigleria causation theory of rheumatoid arthritis. Always looking for that causative organism that's causing that inflammatory response. Right.
And see, isn't that interesting?
It is interesting.
My bias, and I'll say it that way after all these years of doing this, is that autoimmune means we haven't figured out where the bug is.
I just want to make a comment just before I forget it. This is off topic, but this is so interesting because I'm writing this book on oxytocin. I believe that birth is potentially the most post-traumatic stress disorder phenomena or scenario that can ever happen, because you come from this pristine, isolated womb, and then you're going out into the world. It could be very pro-inflammatory, and the mom is secreting all this oxytocin to contract the uterus and ultimately to contract the milk glands to let the milk down, and oxytocin is very flushed through the baby's body to tamp down the inflammation so the baby doesn't get all this walling off and all this potential immune dysregulation from popping out into this brand new, potentially dangerous and traumatic world. And I think we're going to see oxytocin be part of our armamentarium for a lot of these issues that we're talking about because of that. I'm just starting to look at it clinically. Very interesting. And this was off topic, but I just had to kind of jump in.
Yes and no. I mean, you and I have had a few conversations about oxytocin and the neuroinflammation we see in Lyme.
Right, right.
And Lyme also, and probably, if you truly become chronically infected, can disrupt hormones in multiple ways, not just because of the stress response. So, I think it's probably very pertinent.
Right. And you're a hormone specialist too. And because one, in and of itself, you understand the foundational role of hormones, but also yes, because many of your patients in late Lyme also have, as a downstream adverse consequence, have hormones that are dysregulated. Hormone intervention besides nutritional and lifestyle is part of your treatment bigger picture. I am going to want to kind of give a little summation. I know it's difficult at the end to give your thoughts of this bigger picture of how you approach the Lyme patient. But it's just interesting. I got introduced when I was lecturing in Toronto. It kind of blew my mind. I was lecturing a few months ago in Toronto to a group of pharmacists and medical docs, few naturopaths. They said Dr. Wright introduced to the compounding pharmaceutical industry 25 years ago bioidentical hormones, and it was a game changer. And 7 years ago, Dr. Berkson introduced oxytocin. It was a game changer. So we're starting to suddenly look at oxytocin clinically as a game-changing tool. And it is a tool for some of these tick-borne diseases. I truly believe this, as well as other inflammation out of control and other things. Because, I mean, obviously, we have oxytocin receptors all over the body, and wherever there's receptors, it has an action. And we're looking at it, for example, in gut diseases, because you have oxytocin receptors all throughout the gut. But anyway, I just wanted to mention that because it's so interesting. You know, first you have inflammation to help healing and when it's appropriate. Then you have inflammation when it's excessive and it doesn't help healing and it can wall off. And that's an interesting concept that you're introducing, which then doesn't allow the body to get to what it needs to get to.
Yeah. And I'll just say quickly, and this is Lyme 401, and I'm just learning to understand it, but Borrelia seems to manipulate the immune system. So when it enters, you have the Th2 response, you have the calm down, we're good guys response, and later you get the inflammatory response. And it's not clear if that's just a mistake, because it's hard to figure out how that helps it out.
Say to the audience, that's the lay audience, what the Th2 is.
So in most diseases, when you start, you get inflamed, and that's called a Th1 response, just to make life easy. You're literally going to go blow up whatever it is that's chasing you. You're going to capture it. You're going to confine it. You're going to chop it up and recycle it. You're going to take care of that problem. And then the immune system always has a 1-2 punch. And the 2 punch is, hey, guess what? We've done it. Let's fix all the, you know, let's fix this tissue over here. The house fell down while we were blowing things up. Let's build it back up and
The fallout. Let's fix the fallout.
Inflammatory response. That's a very
I didn't hear that. The what inflammatory?
anti-inflammatory. Okay. That TH2 is more of a call the troops off, go home. let's go back to baseline and enjoy things here. So
this bug can come in and actually make the body think it's friend, not foe.
That's right. Either friend or not there.
And that's probably an evolutionary deal.
Yeah.
Because it wants to live. Yeah. Right. But then it makes it difficult for us. So if you were going to, is tying things up now, and honestly, it's been such, I just love hanging out with you. And you and I can talk for hours. I remember one time we were rooming together at a conference, and it was hard for us to leave the room to go listen to the lectures because we can go so deep. And there's not a lot of people you can go that deep with and also have fun with and kind of just be on the same plane where one person isn't lecturing to the other, but you're really exploring together, which is what I always love about talking with you, Chris. So if we were looking at the bigger picture, you know, you got the antibiotics, you got the herbs, you got the lifestyle, the hormones, maybe down the road. What can you just give us a little summation in your mind of your bigger picture in treatment for tick-borne disease patients?
Yes. And, again, I am an integrative physician. One of the things I think I've learned from my patients and from the way I've treated is that, again, I'm going to use that word arrogant, that we got a little arrogant, that we began to think, well, as long as we're healthy and maintaining our health and doing everything right, nothing can harm us. And nothing else is going to get the upper hand. And that's why I do emphasize the antibiotics, the infections, because I think we've let, I mean, that's very interesting about life extension. I didn't know there was a time they said take a low dose doxy for all those, you know, potentially, because I think we have started to ignore the fact that we are ecosystems and that things adapt to us and we adapt to things too. And for the most part, that's a good thing. Our biome's friendly, right? As long as it is. And so the way I approach it is, and some of this is because I've become what you might call an in-referral for sick Lyme patients. I initially establish if I think there is an ongoing infection or there isn't. If there is an ongoing infection in my analysis and the patient has not been treated with antibiotics, I will normally approach first with antibiotics. And here's why. Some people, that's all you have to do. Their system's still intact, but the bug has gotten the upper hand. They would be well. They wouldn't be in my office if their immune system could do it on their own. And also because after my first three very sick Lyme patients from 1989 to 1982, when I gave them IV antibiotics.
1989 to 1992?
Yeah, just okay. Somehow that's when I was just seeing occasional. And I was very slow to go to IV, but when I did on those particular patients, they all got well after years of being sick. So then I said, wait a minute, I'm an integrative physician. I don't want to give antibiotics. I'm going to send these people to the herbalist, I'm in California, to the acupuncturist, to, you know, what I call sometimes the woo-woo docs. But many of them did not get well. And my conclusion was, these bugs are smart enough to get the upper hand. You got to hit them hard for some period of time. Then what do I do? Then I look at what's going on. If the patient walks, you know, if like they go, whew, I'm well. And often if you treat early enough, they can go on to their normal health behaviors. If they want me to help them have healthier life, then I start checking hormones. Then I check nutrient levels. Then I look at how they're eating, and et cetera. Now, if I think we've eradicated the bug or we've done it enough so the immune system now is on top and can control what's going on, then they're not well, then I assess what I think is going on. And more than I used to, I am using things that I call them the woo-woo things.
Like what?
that like neurostim or neurofeedback. Some of the light therapies, and again, this is a book I didn't put in here, but basically using the neuroplasticity information to really start seeing if we can heal the neural pathways.
I took a relicensing course from Norm Shealy, a 40-hour relicensing course at his University of Missouri, and he started pain medicine. He was a neurosurgeon, and now he's gone to energetic medicine, and he uses a lot of these quite a bit. And it was amazing to see he invented the TENS unit, or he says a chiropractor first invented it, a naturopath altered it, and then he put the first one to go to market, and somebody else took it totally to market, and all three of them got screwed. I hate getting screwed without having an orgasm, man.
So I have been very slow to come here, but I think and accessible to patients are the Norman Doidge books, Doidge, which really lays down the science of neuroplasticity. Probably before I do that, I do go and look at hormone balance, everything from thyroid to adrenals, which often suffer in these patients. And that can be truly autoimmune because a lot of these patients end up with Hashimoto's.
Do you think that's because these infections cause a storm of excessive gut wall permeability or leaky gut?
Oh, interesting. I don't know. I do know that inflammatory, viral states lead to Hashimoto's. I know there's a belief sometimes that there's a virus involved.
At A4M, Dr. Jill Carnahan was saying that she sees in these infections, especially tick-borne infections, she sees that the tight junctions are damaged quite a bit and that there's excessive bacterial translocation of what's inside the gut lumen that shouldn't go into the bloodstream that causes a lot of continuing worsening of quality of life.
Yeah, well, Freed, a guy named, I don't know his first name, way back in the mid-90s, maybe early 2000, he's a pediatric GI doc. And after, as you may know, the H. pylori gentleman won the Nobel Prize.
Right,
after
the Australian scientist, right.
It became very, GI docs got interested in infection in the gut. And what Freed did is he took, I think, the first 90 kids after he was funded to do this and just tested what was in the gut. And Bartonella is frequently infecting the gut. Lyme is not infrequently infecting the gut. So as you know, anytime you get inflammation in the gut, you're going to start getting leaky gut. You're going to lose tight junctions, et cetera.
And what's so interesting is you can use hormones to tighten up those tight junctions. That's one of the reasons mole doctors test for transforming growth factor beta 1 in the blood, because we've now learned that TGF beta 1 also helps caretake tight junctions, and spore therapy. Have you gotten into spore therapy for controlling tight junctions at all? Okay, so that's another conversation.
The other thing I do is I introduce people to things like autophagy.
Right.
And to autophagy enhancers when you mentioned TGF beta 1.
I was always pronouncing it as autophagy. Is it autophagy? Have I been like sounding like a hillbilly all this time? Is it autophagy?
I think it's autophagy. I've listened to YouTubes, et cetera. So much.
Just to say it while you're thinking, autophagy is cellular repair, right?
Exactly. I try to maximize that, whether it's use of things like lithium, ECGC. I try to look at that. And I'm no expert here. I'm learning. But TGF-beta 1 is one of the ways you assess active autophagy. So I've been trying to learn a panel to accept.
That's one of the molecules. We were talking before we got on air about these molecules that I'm measuring more and more to try and heal people that are driving disease. And I'm measuring TGF-beta 1 quite a bit. But it was in diving into the literature, it was so interesting to see that it has a lot to do with tight junction health. All over the body, from the lymph system to the gut. There, you have tight junctions everywhere, the blood-brain barrier. But anyway, we're going to have to kind of pull this all together because otherwise we're going to have people.
I think I've summarized. I think, you know, what I look to do is to heal the tissue, especially neural tissue.
And your favorite players for healing neuro tissue are? Your favorite top few players for healing neuro tissue?
Hormone balance.
Okay.
I haven't mentioned this, allergies, you know.
Identifying.
Sensitivity, is something potentially inflaming the brain that way?
Good point.
You mentioned mold toxin. I don't look for toxin as much as I look for mold colonization because I'm treating these people with antibiotics, and I didn't say, you know, you got to be careful about that candida overgrowth and you got to worry about that too. And nutrition and movement and getting your fitness back. You can't get well from a chronic illness if you don't get your fitness back. And I would just tell you my favorite thing for rehab, and it works for POTS patients right now, is called a VASPR.
What is that? Now, I'm so glad that we hung out long enough to get to this because movement is so important and this was so important to get to. What is VASPR?
VASPR is an exercise machine developed on NASA grounds, but not by NASA.
VASPAR?
P-E-R, like Casper, only with a V.
VASPR. Okay. We're going to have to put this in the show notes. This is really important. Okay. So where do people find out about this?
So go to VASPR.com.
Okay. VASPR.com. We'll put that in the show notes. And it's a set of specific exercises to get your fitness back?
It's a high-intensity interval training that you do on a machine that ices you.
What do you mean it ices you?
I mean, it ices you. You're on ice. And you have tourniquets with ice constricting blood flow into your muscles so that you hit Vmax, you get a higher Vmax, and you don't build up lactic acid.
Oh, so are you...
And you're in a partial recumbent position.
Uh-huh.
Which is really... If you're rehabbing POTS people...
Right.
Got to have them partially recumbent because they have to have that cardiovascular support if you've got a dysautonomia.
So can they purchase this machine at this site? Is that what it is?
Probably.
And how much is that?
Machine.
How much is it?
I did look at thinking of bringing it into my office for people. It's $46,000 at least.
Well, this isn't something people are going to be able to go out and do.
No.
So where do they go do this?
Here is why I'm mentioning this.
Okay.
Because VASPR is in a very big marketing right now. And many physical therapists, many athletic trainers who are helping kids get their optimum athletic, they're putting it in their places.
I see. So there's places where specialists and facilities will have VASPR. So if you've had these chronic tick-borne diseases and you want, it's not just antibiotics, it's not just hormone balancing and nutrition or herbs, it's also getting your fitness back, and you might want to inquire into your medical community and your training community and your town who has a VASPR machine that you can be doing these exercises on. Right?
Exactly. And if not that, to understand in a sense what their parameters are, because there may be 100 ways to cut that cake, right?
So if someone doesn't have access to that, what might they be doing at home that might simulate this a little bit?
Exactly. Or in their gym.
And what would that be?
Exactly.
What would that be?
Well, I'm not going to go there right
okay.
now.
Okay. You know. Well, that's you have the right. You have the right, because you've given us so much information. I want to thank you for all this information, and the show notes on this show are just going to be absolutely unbelievable. If you love this kind of information, please go to iTunes and leave us a review. If you want to email me, you can email me at info@drlindseybergson.com. If you have some topics that you want us to do a show on, I can't thank you enough. This is critical information, and you did the really delicate and difficult task here, Chris, of addressing a show to both layers, to the docs and the pharmacists that are listening and also the lay audience. I think you really beautifully addressed both audiences. So thank you so much for the show. Is there, and if people want to see you as a patient, how do they get to you?
So I hasten to say that I'm a busy doc.
Right. You're booking a year out, I know, if not a little bit more than a year out.
And I would go to my website, ChristineGreenMD.com. And that gives you links to different things. In fact, it was very nice preparing this information for you. It'll go on my website. So people have links.
Great. You were multitasking.
And I do encourage, there are on that information, there are websites that will help patients who believe they may have tick-borne disease find physicians in their area.
Remember, the show notes have a lot of incredible resources to help you as a patient or as a doc. And so look at these show notes, because they're rich, rich in information. Thank you so much, you over there in that beautiful area, Los Altos, California, and my dear, dear friend that I've known for so many decades, and you just keep getting better and better and deeper, you just haven't slowed down in any way, and I really appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate you doing this great show, and I'm going to listen away.
You know, and put the show up on your site if you feel like it, you know? Spread the word. Okay.
Take
Thank
care.
You so much. And give my love to Cordell, okay, and your kids. Bye, honey.
Bye-bye.
Bye.